The Sound Barrier podcast from Silent London is released fortnightly, and each episode discusses two films, a new release and a classic from the silent era that complements or matches it in some way. To find out more, visit silentlondon.co.uk or search for Silent London on iTunes.
¿Personaje secundario? ¿Yo? No, no señor, porque te voy a agarrar.
Hello and welcome to the Sound Barrier podcast with me, Pamela Hutchinson.
And me, Pete Barham.
In this episode, we'll be talking about two films about poets. So poetry is big in film right now, with last year's Patterson, directed by Jim Jarmusch, and right now, Terence Davis's excellent Emily Dickinson biopic, A Quiet Passion, is in cinemas. However, we'll be talking about two films that offer portraits of poets in exile, poets whose words can rouse a nation and break hearts. These films mythologise their subjects, who are great populist leaders and legendary lovers both, but neither movie is quite what it appears to be. Our two picaresque poets are Pablo Neruda from Chile and François Villon from France.
So I'll be talking about Villon, who is the lead character of The Beloved Rogue, a 1927 swashbuckler directed by Alan Crossland, starring John Barrymore as Villon, renowned to be the father of modern French poetry. Born the year of Joan of Arc's martyrdom, which the film ties into to show the ongoing wars between England and France, and by the time this film is actually set with a grown Villon, Burgundy, Villon is a revolutionary hero in the film, perhaps. But not much is really known about Villon's life. There are legends of petty crime, which eventually would potentially lead to his death. However, he's been significantly romanticised in literature. Audiences of the 1920s would be a bit more familiar with this romanticised Villon. There have been two previous silent stabs at his tale, all inspired by the 1901 novel If I Were a King by Justin Hartley McArthur, which came up with this idea of this swashbuckling Villon. The Beloved Rogue diverts from that storyline to make him even more broadly like Robin Hood, which Barrymore plays up in his acting. Here, say in Paris, Villon becomes the King of Fools on New Year's Day, gets into trouble with Guy of Gisborne-esque Duke of Burgundy, played by Lawson Butt, and banished from Paris by the King, Louis XI, Conrad of Vate, a superstitious and easily led ruler. Thrown into the mix is a winsome love interest, Charlotte de Vercel, played by Marceline Day, whose marriage is meant to cement France and Burgundy's union. Villon's actions, however, and latter heroics put a spanner in the works, so to speak, in a way that bears very little resemblance to any actual history. Well, that never bothered Robin Hood, and doesn't trouble Barrymore here, who's tried to out Fairbanks Fairbanks, leaping and prancing and wearing a felt cap like he was playing Robin Hood. Possibly of more interest, though, is Vate's grotesque performance as the King. The Beloved Rogue is an interesting piece of 1927's Hollywood, a broad caper which cares little for Villon and his reputation as a poet, but never quite becoming a straight adventure mover either. It wasn't a huge hit. The lovers of Barrymore will have a lot to see and admire.
There's a lot of Barrymore to see and admire in that film. I do agree with you, Pete. Pablo Lorenz Neruda offers a glimpse of the poet and politician Pablo Neruda in 1948, when his fame was at its height, but he was forced to go into hiding. So Neruda was a senator for the Chilean Communist Party, and when President González Videla outlawed communism, he became a wanted man. The film, which Lorenz has called an anti-bio, which sounds like some kind of cleaning chemical, focuses on Neruda, played by Luis Gnecco, and the policeman on his trail, Oscar Pollutiono, played by Gael Garcia Bernal. Now, Neruda, as played by Gnecco, is a man of great charisma and playful charm, but also a decadent man, a devotee of sensual pleasures and a fan of pulp fiction. Neruda plays a mischievous game of cat and mouse with the authorities, hiding in plain sight and resisting his enforced house arrest. Mercedes Morán brings warmth and softness to her portrayal of his loving aristocratic wife Delia, who is almost always by his side, but Neruda's aura seems to floor everyone he encounters, from a street urchin to a drag singer performing in a brothel to a mob of journalists. Even his ex-wife, roped in to help find the supposed traitor, remains under his spell. And no one is more entranced by Neruda than the detective Pollutiono. His dogged pursuit of Neruda cements the poet's status as a popular hero, but it may just be the case that Pollutiono owes his life to the man he is hunting down. So the tension between the diligent detective Pollutiono and the flamboyant champagne socialist Neruda is foregrounded in Lorraine's sumptuous period film, which thrives on the performances of Gnecco and Bernal. Flashes of sunlight pierce the earthy gloom of a official and domestic interiors and its warm wine red and mahogany colour palette. Startling images such as Gnecco made up to look like Lawrence of Arabia or a row of urinals in a government meeting room add a flourish of romanticism and revelry to this historical drama. Neruda is ultimately a tribute to the poet and to the people who followed him. It's also a tribute to the power of literature and its capacity to inspire love and rebellion, or to create fantasy worlds that are vivid enough to be mistaken for reality.
Han pasado solo 3 años desde el fin de la Segunda Guerra Mundial y aquí está a punto de empezar una persecución fabulosa.
Con ustedes, el poeta Pablo Neruda.
Puedo escribir los versos más tristes esta noche.
Dicen que Neruda es el comunista más importante del mundo.
Soy perseguido en el último sitio del mundo donde yo hubiese querido que eso ocurriera, aquí en Chile.
Muy buena tarde, señor presidente.
¿Conoce usted a Neruda?
No, yo no.
So, when I chose these two films to go together, and I'm going to take full credit / blame for this pairing.
Responsibility.
I should always take responsibility for my actions. I tried the pairing out on a couple of people, and I did get a few raised eyebrows.
Excellent, and rightly so, because they are quite different.
They appear to be quite different, but I do think they have quite a lot in common as well.
No, I do agree with you. I've been told not to agree with you too much, so let's see if we can tease that out.
Well, I think, so immediately, they're very different. So the Lorraine film has all the sort of trappings of an arthouse film. It's very intellectual. It deals with serious history, a true life figure. And there's even though we'll talk a lot about its relationship to history, there's a certain, what we always like to call verisimilitude in the way they present it. It looks right most of the time.
Yeah.
And The Beloved Rogue looks like a, you know, turquoise blue Christmas card come to life.
Yeah, and it's set on All Fool's Day, starts on the 1st of January. There's snow everywhere, though the verisimilitude on the snow is not the kind of snow that melts.
No.
It's not the kind of snow that seems in any way wet, and it's certainly not the kind of snow that seems cold.
No, but it's a good snow for sliding down rooftops on. And he's a tomcat who knows the rooftops well.
He is a rooftop denizen, I'd say. He likes his rooftops. In fact, from a heroic point of view, I mean, I mentioned that there's a lot of Robin Hood in this.
Mm.
They're actually, the bit that there isn't in this is that he doesn't really fight very often.
No.
He runs away a lot. He's very good at evading people, but he doesn't really fight.
Well, I mean, Neruda also. I mean, these people are lovers, not fighters. And that's one of the things that connects them.
Yes.
There are more things that connect these films, I think. There's a certain playfulness with genre.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about these are poets who are populist heroes and also poets who are quite decadent types. So there's a lot of the glamour, the idea of being a poet and a literary figure here.
No, absolutely. I think poetry is where we should start.
I think we should start with poetry too. Yeah. Why? Because that's first on our list.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. So when we talk about poetry, when you've got film about poets, as we're talking about Patterson and Quiet Passion and things like that, you want to hear the text. So I think that these two films have quite a different way of approaching that. So in Neruda, he's got the love poem or the romantic poem that people constantly ask him to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And it has this amazing effect on people, even though he's a little bit jaded about performing it.
As are people around him as well. An awful lot of people. I mean, it is a performance. And so he is. We open Neruda with a party where he is Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, yeah. It's one of the early scenes. Yeah.
One of the early scenes. And where he is delivering this poetry. And people are swooning around him. It's all the one. Clearly for him, this is part of his legend. This is what he does.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, the film is cynical about it, I think. Mm. I think he does look at it and sort of say, even at this point, he's clearly decadent. The party is there to show his decadence. And then particularly when he is then confronted with other members of the Communist Party, who he has to meet whilst dolled up in his eye makeup and ask them, and you know, offers them a bottle of wine, which they don't want to have. And
no.
So it's, yeah, as a communist, he stands out.
He does stand out. But it's interesting, I think later in the film they show him constructing a poem that will be disseminated. And this is his poem that's meant to, if it's not meant to incite rebellion, it's meant to sort of remind people of where the communists stand. It's the voice of Neruda speaking to the people. He's constructing it very carefully, I wouldn't say cynically necessarily, to have a specific effect on people. So there's, as you say, quite a cynical aspect to the poetry here.
Yeah, and I think Lorraine is more cynical than Neruda is. I think Neruda may not recognise the contradictions. You know, he believes in his own legend at this point. And so he believes there's a famous speech which he does to Parliament, which is just before he goes into exile, where his oration is well known, and he kicks that out there and everyone cheers. And it is this, you know, well-off, someone who'd been in government or been a diplomat, representing the people and being the most famous person in Chile as well. He was the most famous person, and still probably is one of the most famous, who wasn't a dictator anyway.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think that's a great club to be in, you know?
Yeah.
You know, one of the most famous people in my country that wasn't a dictator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And maybe that was just because the chance didn't turn up. But no, I mean, I think his latter trips and so on. I would disagree.
Yeah, I'm not going to speculate too much on the politics. But then in The Beloved Rogue, we have a guy who was everywhere lauded as a great poet, and he's quite happy not only to speak lines, but actually to make up poetry on the spot.
He knocks them out like that,
doesn't
he?
He does knock them out. And I would say that the poems in The Beloved Rogue have a certain quality.
Doggerel is the word I would use. Now, I don't know Fionn's poetry. I don't know if these are actual translations of his poems. I'm willing to put down a fair bet that they're not.
Can I read one? Just
please.
An example. This is kind of a meet cute when he first meets Marceline Day. So I think it's an important poem within the narrative, right?
Okay, come on. So, please, before.
Okay, I have to use what Neruda would call his poet's voice.
Put the felt cap on.
I've left the chamber of many a dame in a haste that was free from discussion, but never before in a lady's boudoir have I landed with such a concussion.
But this is in at the end of an action sequence where he has found himself catapulted across the roofs of Paris accidentally by himself.
Yeah.
And luckily ended up in our heroine's bedchamber.
Which is a perfectly comfortable place to land. But he sort of says, if I'm dead, I'm glad.
Yes, because I have such a vision of beauty in front of me. Well, I'll do this one then.
Okay, you do this one.
So this is where we actually see him in the actual act of trying to write poetry
it's quite a privilege, isn't
it? Yes, it is. And you see him there. He's been banished from Paris by the king at this point. He's trying to work something out. Maybe some political poetry. Louis the Little is a dwarf in the film. He's one of the group of people that Fionn hangs around with.
He's got his posse.
They're men who seem quite merry.
Yes, they are merry men.
No. Not many. So, Louis the Little, come be big. Bid the cursed Burgundians dance. On the gallows they should jig if Fionn were King of France.
Well, I mean, that would captivate a nation.
Now, the key thing about that poem as well is that just before he writes it, he curses the fact that he can't think of anything apart from the word dance to rhyme with France.
Or dance to rhyme with France.
Or dance to rhyme with France, depending on where you're from.
Yes.
Here or France.
So, Eugene, he's had bants, had pants, he's had all these great words.
It's all there. The character who is supposed to be the kind of the French Chaucer.
Yeah, something like that.
I would guess. He's not given the kind of respect I would expect from a poetry perspective.
And the thing is that I think that there is definitely a playful quality to this film as well, which we'll talk about a little bit more. So there's a certain humour and a certain charm. You know, Fionn, you know, it's not meant to be serious. It's meant to be it's a Hollywood film that everyone can understand. But there is something quite absurd about having John Barrymore supposedly speaking such terrible lines, because we all know that he is familiar with slightly better poetry.
He can read best poetry. I mean, obviously, we don't get the full vocal performance anyway. It is a silent movie, after all. Mm. But yeah.
Thanks for pointing this out,
sorry,
by the way.
Just in case we hadn't mentioned that in the setup for the show.
I didn't actually point out. Yeah. By the way, guys, we're going to be talking about one silent film, one sound film.
So, yes, he can deliver this. He does feel like he knows it's a little beneath him as well. And I think that's one of the interesting things when we come onto the performances, where Barrymore's doing lots of interesting things here. But one of the things he's doing is not quite committing wholeheartedly to the piece, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because when you think about poetry and you think about film, they're such very different art forms. The way that they are made, the way that they are experienced seems very different. And I know we've both seen it, so I can bring this in, but in A Quiet Passion, because we're talking about Emily Dickinson and how she feels about writing her work and her publishing and all this kind of thing, there's text everywhere in voiceover, you know, several of the poems. I don't know how many poems. I tried to make note at some point, but there were like
loads.
Yeah. Loads is a good number.
50% of the film feels like it may be poetry.
Are several quotations, and that becomes part of the texture of the film because it's trying to get you inside the sort of interior space of Emily Dickinson's mind. In neither of these films are we really there. We watch Neruda sort of sweating away at his typewriter, and you see Fionn sort of composing verses after he's had a jug of wine, but it's not that kind of... It's more about poets than poetry.
Yes, and I think it's about, you know, look, the poetry must be good and interesting because they had good and interesting lives, which is kind of the opposite to the point of A Quiet Passion, it being our sort of triangular film here, like we did last week with Common Skull Island, that we've got this third film that we will get referred to every now and then. In A Quiet Passion, she has no life almost. There's almost nothing there in the... And that's kind of what she's railing against, that she has she hasn't the opportunity, but has the ability to create very interesting poetry and quite moving poetry around that. You know, the poet and the artist doesn't need to have a spectacular life to create great art. And in both of these films, in some ways, the fact that they created great art is a given, so we don't really need to delve into it, I think.
Well, I think what's interesting, in particularly in The Beloved Rogue, which I'm going to say is interrogating this question much more deeply than Neruda, and actually to a certain extent in Neruda as well, it's the women who point out these differences. So Marceline Day's character, quite specifically, is she called Charlotte?
Charlotte,
quite specifically says, she says something like, a man who's such a great poet must be a great man. So when she first meets John Barrymore's villain, she can't believe that really is villain. That wouldn't make no sense. And later, this discussion of I'm in love with the poet, not the courtier, and all this kind of thing. And I think with Neruda, it's slightly more subtle distinction. It's more, the fact that at the end of the day, Delia sort of wants a husband as well as...
There's something interesting about Neruda as well, and in the film, which we may touch on a little bit later, but at the kind of last segment of the film, which is his escape from Chile, he refers to massively in his speech to the Nobel Prize, when he won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1971. It's about the first half of his speech. He's describing this in great detail in poetic language, but not as a poem. And massively romanticised. And so there is a sense that we do see the creation of an aspect of the artwork. And this is the point where the film starts becoming much more self-referential and meta about who the characters are, what the characters are, and the process of making art, which I think Neruda is a lot about that, about, the whole, print legend type stuff.
Yeah.
It's, can the artist create their own legend? Which I think is the centre of Neruda.
And I think, it's really, really glad that you brought up the last sequence of Neruda, especially in the topic of poetry, because, as you say, it's related a lot to the way he talks about that particular aspect, that particular incident in his life. But I think it's impossible to watch the film and see this section and not think of the end of Frankenstein. So there's a kind of literary reference point for this particular scene and the way it's played out with the snow and so on.
Though equally, actually, from another recent reference, The Revenant as well. There's aspects of that landscape and death and so on out there, which made me think of The Revenant.
Interesting. I haven't seen The Revenant.
Certainly cinematography, in as much as we're not going short on lens flare.
Lens flare is really important in Neruda. I think we should talk about that under style. Because
I think we will,
It's almost quite surprising.
It is.
I think we might be in a position to give points.
Yes.
So when it comes to talking about poetry, which film do you think wins? I think it's a really close call.
It is a really close call. I kind of want to give it a dead heat. Because I think they both aren't as interested in it as a thing, but are interested in it as a garnish to the personalities of their men.
I think we can say that both films are about poets rather than poetry. But if you had to talk about poetry, I'm afraid I am going to be a bit harsh and say that Neruda nudges it for me, because the poetry in The Beloved Rogue is
terrible. It is terrible. Okay, now I will agree with you. If we talk about poetry, then Neruda gets it, because the poems are the actual poems as well.
Okay, great. So that's 2 points for Neruda. So the next area on our list, and if you want to go by the list, I mean, who cares what rules, is myth-making and heroism. So we're sort of talking about these heroic figures. I think it's a nice segue from the talking about them as poets and how you build the myth of the character. Obviously, one of them's got centuries on the other.
Well, one's got kind of a whole country as elevating him as their national hero.
Yeah.
I mean, Neruda as a film is explicitly about myth making, and I think its own cynicism about that, I think, it now feels it's in a comfortable position to interrogate the myth of Neruda, who is a national hero, globally seen as one of the greatest poets of the 20th century. Chile, the most famous man from Chile. Was he this great person, or was he a decadent bourgeois communist who...
A lecher
who left his wife behind in Chile and went off with someone else when he got to France, who, built up his own myth maybe above that of what was needed in the country. The film takes place at exactly that turning point in many ways, I think. And I think the film invites us to look at that myth and say, was it worth it, or where it goes.
At some point we might have to get a bit spoilertastic with Neruda. One of the things I think is really interesting is that they both are about poets in exile, so they're poets that become national heroes, and that's almost defined by this period of exile. Villon gets in trouble and they say, Paris is alive to you, so you must leave Paris, and obviously Neruda has to go into hiding. And there's something about this sort of sense of victimhood which puts them on the same par as the people, I suppose. With Neruda, it's very explicit in the film, the idea that the fact that he's been hunted down is part of his legend and makes him, you know, a bigger figure. And it's almost his creation, the idea that he is in such danger. In The Beloved Rogue, you know, when Villon is outside the city walls of Paris and things like that.
He's exiled from Paris, but he does seem to go about, yeah, to a pub just outside of Paris.
Is that the Lame Flea?
Something like that. So like South Mim service station, not Paris.
Exactly. We need to go there for a pint afterwards. And, you know, he concocts a scheme to bring supplies to the people, the besieged people. He fires meat and bread, but also brandy. And they say, oh, only Villon would have thought of brandy. Yes. And so, you know,
The deadly firing of barrels at people. Luckily, no one was killed.
Well, you do think that there might be a few infants would be squished by a bottle of brandy.
Indeed, yeah.
But yeah, so, I mean, it's that thing of like, how do you become a national hero and then also be really loved by the people? And you have to sort of put yourself among the people. And one of the things that Neruda does quite a lot is that he hides among the people. I mean, I think he does quite a few cheeky little hiding sequences, which you wouldn't believe you could get away with. They are jokes, I think, in the film.
Yeah, there's one where he's basically in the frame of a picture.
He's in the frame of a picture.
And then he moves from the picture as Bernal walks past. And yeah, it's clearly a gag. And that's Lorraine being playful, which he is all the way through the film. There's lots of playful aspects.
And he dresses up as a prostitute, doesn't he, in the brothel and things like that.
I mean, they're both playful about this, and I think they're both interesting. I mean, what's interesting about The Beloved Rogue is that, as far as I understand it, the Villon myth isn't that concrete. You know, these are all being made up. So the 1901 book, the idea of being king, and then he gets given the power to do this, and it's a wish fulfillment idea. This stuff is all completely made up in this film. I mean, it really comes from nowhere.
There's absolutely nothing of it. But there's really a poignant scene, I think, when as you were talking about, it's opening on All Fool's Day, and he is appointed like chief fool or lord of misrule or whatever it is. And Villon is dressed up as a clown. You know, and he's got all these prosthetics on his face. You can barely see who it is. People can't see that it's Villon, but it's Barrymore through those eyes. And you see how distraught he is to be.
There is a fact. I mean, it's probably the best sequence in The Beloved Rogue, which is when he gets banished at the end of that sequence. And the camera just holds on him for about 30 seconds as his makeup is slowly washing up, or is washing his makeup off. Look of pure anguish in his eyes is really quite moving, whilst at the same time completely out of place with the entirety of the rest of the film. Because the next time we see him, he's in The Flea, and he's gadding about with the dwarf, writing a terrible poem and concocting a plan to bombard the people of Paris with goods.
Basically, what Villon does for France, for Paris, what he does is, it's a scam. It's all gags. You know, it's like the white wine scam, where he sort of gets a free jug of white wine. It's all a trick. He tricks the king. We have to mention Conrad Veidt is just brilliant here. I love Conrad Veidt. This is his first Hollywood role, and he's somehow crouching down, so he's shorter than John Barrymore, which is no mean feat. And he's got his hands all over his face and up his nose half the time, and he really is the weak king
It's such a strange but compelling performance. He's doing all that. I remember when I was a child actor, you know, and I was one of my favourite acting classes was to say, imagine the animal that you think is in this character, and it's like, here he's kind of going for a crab mixed with a warthog.
So one of the things is interesting when it comes to myth making is that Beloved Rogue, despite the fact that it seems like a far less serious film, it really goes for it. So we have this little prologue where you see how Villon's father died for France. Mm-hmm. And so although Villon's approach is obviously much more playful, it literally comes down to pulling a gag on the king in the end. The end of the day, he just pulls the easiest gag in the world on the king, because the king is stupid, and that manages to get everything done. But he's born to greatness. We see that actually the prologue is quite compelling.
It is surprising. And then we have this prologue of his dad dying, and at the same time as Joan of Arc, he's another martyr. Mm-hmm. And he is 20 years later, his son.
Villon is no martyr.
He's no martyr. And, you know, it's quite close in places, but he's no martyr.
But, you know, it's the opposite, because I think in Neruda, and I remember thinking this was quite striking, and almost that thing where I watched Neruda at the London Film Festival. So I sat down, I must admit, not knowing that much about the film before I sat down. And the opening scene where he's having the meeting in Parliament and he's talking to everyone, and then suddenly the meeting room they're in is also the gentleman's toilet.
Yes.
So he's also like at the urinals. It's very much underplaying. Instead of saying, look at these great men discussing great affairs of the nation, he's one of the great men, it's immediately undercut. And then everything else that the film does shows you how just an ordinary man can make a myth, rather than the direction that The Beloved Rogue travels in is he is a great man and we're going to show you his humanity.
I mean, I disagree slightly there because I think that it starts also with Neruda being Neruda. They, you know, we do get into we get that sequence, we do get the party sequence where he and we are told that he is the greatest poet in the world. So there is kind of, this is it. And then the film has to try and say, does he live up to that or not? And that's part of the question, you know. Is Neruda living up to his great status, his martyrdom almost of his exile, or is he playing up to it? And certainly with his moments of fitting in, you know, his playful.
I love those.
But of course, they're all completely unnecessary. These are moments where he has wriggled out from his own bodyguard just to have a bit of fun because he knows, or the film suggests, that without that, there is no myth. And without the myth, there is no Neruda.
Yeah. And I think one of the things I thought about quite a lot when I was watching it is, you know, should he have been a poet or should he have been a politician? How can you reconcile the two? I mean, he seems to fit much more easily into the role of the poet, the sort of bard troubadour among the people rather than in the halls debating.
These things aren't necessarily things that should be separated. I mean, we got a great history of poets as poets and authors as politicians. So, you know.
Geoffrey Archer.
Why was I going to go to Geoffrey Archer's? I was going to go to Disraeli, obviously.
We're children of the 80s, yes, and we cannot help it.
To Geoffrey Archer, so so therefore this also maybe colours our view on...
And that they're all a bunch of lying...
Yes,
yeah.
And that.
Okay.
And so on that bombshell, I think, we should probably score this.
We should score on myth-making. So I think that Neruda tells us more interesting things about myth-making and gives us a stronger myth. I think that the Vion myth actually is hollow.
I'm going to disagree with you. I'm going to go the other way with this because I think this film is literally making the Vion myth. Well, you know, it's the strongest and fails in some ways because obviously we haven't seen much of Vion since, or at least not in Hollywood. But I think in doing it, it's interesting to watch something making, because the way it, you know, because it's leaning on its Robin Hood stuff, but where it diverts from that is interesting, and what the myth of this man is, which I think we'll come on to shortly.
Yeah, I think that the Ronald Coleman version in 1938 was a bit more successful, wasn't it? Yeah, a bit of a bigger hit. Anyway, okay, so we're going to talk about history next. Now,
you and your knowledge of cinema history.
Well, no, that's fine. It's great. If you want to say that I've got a good knowledge of cinema history, that's amazing, because I've got an absolutely terrible knowledge of actual history with, you know, people in rooms deciding things and going to war and so forth. So two films have very different approaches to history.
Yeah.
One of them, I mean, it might as well be a fairy tale. There's no need for there to be any actual history at all.
I agree,
right.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. No, that would be The Beloved Rogue.
That would be, yes, just in case, on tenterhooks there, yeah. Beloved Rogue with its snow-covered Paris and its twiddling moustache villain.
I mean, if the King of France was really like Conrad Veidt, I mean, we should have heard more about that.
I mean, they've had a lot of lousy kings.
He's a particularly fascinating character and weak-willed character.
Yes.
Easily duped.
Easily duped, yes. When will you die? In 24 hours of your own death, sire. In which case, I will leave you to live. So
yeah, exactly.
That's the trick, kids. That's the trick.
That's the trick. Someone is trying to kill you, say, yes, it has been foretold that you will die 24 hours after me. So they're going to want to put off your execution. Neruda, I think, probably has a lot more complicated relationship to history, despite the fact that, and we are going to have to admit it, that the film contains an entire fiction within itself.
Yes, and it's even doing that stylistically in places.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the rear projection.
Any car journey is done with shonky Alfred Hitchcock rear projection.
That's a definite decision. But, you know, the events of that period are still within living memory. And, you know, it's quite kind of...
Speak for yourself.
But there's a sort of kind of intake of breath moment where you briefly do see a camp, don't you? You see Pinochet.
That's right, yeah.
And because, you know, I think that sort of shows you what we're fighting for here, sort of thing. What's happened to Chile, what's going to happen to Chile, and what it's still just, you know, just about recovering from. So, tell me all about the history, Pete, as you're so clever.
Well, the history of France.
do we think there's a value in something that's so divorced from factual history that as The Beloved Rogue, does it serve any historical purpose whatsoever?
I mean, I think from the point of view of a setting, it's like, this was real, okay? Now, this isn't very real, but, you know, I keep going back to Robin Hood, but it is that thing that Robin Hood bears very little relationship to the actual politics of the time. You know, the idea that Richard was a good king, King Richard Lionheart was a good king, and King John was a bad king, aren't really borne out. You know, one buggered off for years and years and years, one stuck around. So, you know, these things aren't really borne out. But what from an American point of view and from a Hollywood point of view, it's a setting, but it's also... look how decadent the Europeans are. Look at how bad history is. Look how bad kings are. I mean, I think there is, from a presidential country, look how bad kings are is there.
Yeah.
So I do think there is a value to it. And I do think that there is something going on here which is more than just a fairy tale.
Yeah.
Not much more.
I mean, I'm really worried that I'm going to go Neruda all the way here.
Well, the history is better in Neruda. Now, the question is what history? And I think what's interesting about Neruda around history is that this is now a nuanced take.
Yeah.
This is one that isn't interested in making this myth. It's interested in interrogating the myth and saying, OK, well, actually, what did Neruda do for us in 1948? Well, he went into exile.
Mm.
We had a succession of not great governments. He came back.
Mm.
He was a communist, but of a particular type.
The moment when the cleaner comes up to him at the party and she wants her book of poetry signed and she wants a kiss, and she's obviously completely infatuated with him. But she says something like, you know, come the revolution, will we all be equal like me or will we be equal like you? And there's that point where you can just see Pablo Neruda thinking, no, we'll probably all be equal like you. But he says what she wants to hear and he says, you know, we'll all be equal like me.
Well, also what he wants to hear, because he knows he won't be equal like her.
No, he's still going to be
equal like himself. And this is very similar. This point was made in Trumbo last year as well, where Trumbo is asked by his colleague, how can you live like this and still believe in the struggle? And it's kind of like, well, we haven't reached that bit yet. So I haven't had to ask myself that question. I don't need to be consistent yet. When we get there. But that also suggests, also, do they really believe they're going to get there?
Yeah, do you ever think you're going to be in power? You know, there's a lot more sort of hard-nosed realism in a way from Villon. He says, you know, I will always be a low-born rogue. Yeah. Oh, and when he, you know, he's making a good match. I mean, they're very blunt about it. They say, you know, we can't be together. There's no kind of levelling there.
No, and they're absolutely right. Not with that beard, anyway.
You always want to talk about beards. I think it might be time to wrap up history.
I would say so.
I think it might be the end of history.
Well, clearly, because we know very little about it as well. I'm going to score it for Neruda.
I'm scoring that one for Neruda too. Yay for sound film.
En esta ficción, todos giramos alrededor del protagonista. Tiene un principal y un secundario.
Lo que pasa es que usted quiere un escape grandioso.
Para eso luchamos, camarada.
Lo único que le pido es que sea un poco más humilde.
El artista soy yo. El artista aquí soy yo.
En las novelas, el policía persigue al asesino hasta el final.
¡Pablo!
Quiero ser testigo de tu muerte. Y voy a ser personaje principal.
We're going to talk about genre here. I think I'm going to have to make it quite clear what the deal is with Neruda. So Neruda has this detective on his trail, and I'm afraid this is a mild spoiler, maybe quite a serious spoiler, actually. If you haven't seen the film yet, you might not want to know this. He gives these little noir detective novels to the detective on his trail. And then there's a suggestion, more than a suggestion, at the end that actually the detective is entirely a figment of Neruda's own imagination. And we have this idea that he's constructed a whole artificial reality around having this a noir detective with his, you know, with his hat and Gael Garcia Bernal and a hat. It's really even better than John Barrymore and Robin Hood hat
and moustache.
And it's all his own creation. And I think Mercedes Moran as Delia explains it all, and she sort of says, yes, we're all his supporting characters, which is fascinating because actually that's true. Even without it, you know, that it's true that if you're going to be the wife of a great poet, you're going to be a supporting character in his biography.
Even if you are an accomplished artist in your own right, which she is.
Exactly, and we do see a bit of that.
But that said, who is narrating Neruda?
Who is narrating Neruda?
It's Gael Garcia Bernal. The film is presented as a detective film. It is, or at least that's how it starts. Rather than getting the voiceover of Neruda, we get the voiceover of his dogged pursuer, you know, of the cop who is always one step behind, literally, in some cases, one step behind him, and who explains why he hates him.
And, I mean, a lot of people have pointed out that the name Peluchino, it comes from the word for stuffed toy, and he has this very... this is what someone like Neruda would think of as a nowhere man's birth. I think that his father was a policeman and his mother was a prostitute. But, you know, so this film is playing with being a sort of noir detective story.
Yeah.
And in its own way, The Beloved Rogue is playing a game with genre too, or so Barrymore claims. So Barrymore's idea for The Beloved Rogue, he said, was to use the extraordinary figure of Villon, these are his words, as a vehicle to rather burlesque the whole idea of romance. Even though he'd made this film after he'd made Don Juan and When a Man Loves. This had been written before that, and he said that, you know, this was before he became the great lover and before he made these romantic films. So this was more about parodying that whole idea and subverting that whole idea. A lot of people say that the audiences at the time did not get the joke. People didn't think it was anything other than a straightforward romantic caper.
Yeah, and I think it makes a mistake by presenting itself as such. Mm-hmm. I think it is fascinating to look at it that way because he's absolutely right. As I mentioned earlier, he never fights. In fact, he's terrible at fighting. He's not great at... His one superpower is probably climbing and jumping from roofs. And even that he's not great at.
And being naked. He's quite good at being stripped and oiled.
He doesn't do that on purpose. So that's near the end. I mean, he tricks people occasionally. Mm. But, I mean, you know, his grand heroic act of bombarding Paris with deadly barrels of brandy, he then falls into the bucket, gets thrown across himself. He's hapless. He is energetic. He's not super smart. He, as I say, he gets caught more often than not. He's not a hero in the standard sense.
But one of the things I think is difficult is, you know, one of the reasons that the romance doesn't feel like much of a romance film is just because there's really not much chemistry between him and Marceline Day. There's a certain conventionality to the way it's shot. And you see him occasionally in his profile and you see these very romantic scenes where they're standing there discussing how they can't be together and it's awful. You'd have to see quite how thick he lays on in other films to know that this is not John Barrymore going full for romance.
Yeah, this is him, Barrymore light.
Barrymore light on the great lover front, yeah. I think.
Until at least we get to the strip naked stuff when it's a different kind of intensity.
I mean, if you see some of his films, I don't know how many of his films we've seen, there are films like Beau Brummel that end on a very serious note and things like that. And this one, it is almost entirely in the comic mode. I think there's a little part of us that can't quite believe that Hollywood would be serious. So we think that's funny. We find it funny. They'll have taken it really seriously. Mm. But actually, it is a little bit of a spoof. I just think the spoof doesn't quite land.
It doesn't quite land. I think, you know, the fact that, I mean, he denied it himself, but it's quite clear that he's going for a Fairbanks mode here because he's leaping everywhere in a Fairbanks way. And he never quite commits to it completely. But equally, if you think about Fairbanks in Robin Hood or something like that, which goes super dark in places.
I'm just thinking about Fairbanks now.
Yeah,
can you just give
fine.
Me a moment?
Well, I'll talk while you have okay. that look on your face. You know, that's a really dark film in places. It goes some really nasty places, but manages that tone. Whereas this never really quite gets, you know, we get close to him being tortured and, you know, he does get tortured. Really.
Dangled in on a cage.
Yeah, dangled on a cage. I mean, he falls off a very high building that he's climbing. But you never worry too much about him.
No, he's never going to break anyone's back around a pillar like Robin Hood does. It's almost like a lesson between the two films. And if you're going to muck about with genre, maybe you need to tell everyone, because The Beloved Rogue, people don't get it. And Neruda, you can't fail to get it.
Well, yeah, and the problem with Neruda as well is, of course, it genre on paper is a detective thing, but it never is anything that isn't an art house movie.
Yeah.
And its first position is an art house movie. And when we get to this final bit where our narrator realises that he may be a fiction, or actually realises he's a fiction, he takes an awfully long time over realising it.
Yeah.
And it drags. You know, that last quarter drags because of it.
It does drag a bit. I mean, I think all that sequence in the snow is quite beautiful. But yeah, it does feel slow, especially watching it a second time, which I did this week. I was quite interested when you say it feels like nothing but an art house film. It's such a solid art house film.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. And, you know, Lorraine is famous for his choices around cinematography, his choices around stock, even, you know, going back to which is on the pneumatic. Now, here there's less of a thing about stock, but there is a thing about style.
Yeah.
And that's genre as well. But when you go in to see a Lorraine film now, because he is as much of a brand as anything else, you kind of know what you're going to get in certain ways.
Yeah, and it's had such a wide release, I think. I'd have to look at how many cinemas it's in, but I've noticed that it's in cinemas. It's having a run, I think, in the Curzo. In the Curzon Soho, which we could now call the Curzo, I think, on 35mm, and also it's on VOD as well.
Yep.
So, I mean, they're obviously banking on the fact that a lot of people will think there's a new Pablo Larraín film out, and maybe following on from Jackie. Quite a big hype.
You know, and I think there's an interesting question about, of course, how this film is seen in the rest of the world and how this film is seen in Chile.
Mm.
Because in Chile, everyone knows this story. So, you know, you can interrogate this story in a different kind of way. And I don't know how it was received in Chile. I wonder whether there is a degree of the mythologizing which becomes an issue. You know, is he taking apart our national myth within 30 years of his death or 35 years of his death, is that something that's been seen to be a good thing or a bad thing? It's interesting, and I don't know the answer to that bit of a question, unfortunately.
I would say that if you're interested in Chilean cinema, there's a really interesting piece on the Sight and Sound magazine website at the moment about post-Pinochet Chilean cinema, and that talks a lot about Lorraine as being one of the big figures in a much wider, you know, array of directors, obviously, and I think it's really interesting to put him in context in that way. Doesn't talk too much about this film in particular because it's talking about the last sort of 16 years of cinema, but yeah, I would recommend that if you're interested in this topic. To sum up on genre,
for me, The Beloved Rogue is a purer genre film than Neruda.
Is that what we're marking on? We're marking with how it plays with genre.
Or how it plays with genre. I mean, yeah, and I think, you know, I think in the end, once I started working out what it was doing, I enjoyed The Beloved Rogue more from a genre perspective. So I'm going to mark it for genre. Because I think Neruda, to me, when I realised kind of what it was doing, it's like, okay, I've got this now. Now you're going to keep doing it for the next 20 minutes and it should end.
I'm going to go with Neruda again.
Okay.
Just because I really do enjoy the Gael Garcia Bernal character, which we haven't talked about too much. So seeing as how I enjoy Gael Garcia Bernal so much, the next category that we're going to talk about is personalities, because we've got some stonking performances here to talk about.
Oh, yes, we do.
So do you want to kick off?
Okay, let's go with Beloved Rogue, and I'm going to start with The King. Let's go with Conrad Veidt. We've already mentioned his crabby acting style or whatever, but I think what's interesting in the film as well is that The King rescues himself. If the film is about Villon saving France, the way he saves France is by getting caught.
Yeah.
And by somehow drawing out of the Duke of Burgundy the suggestion that this is what happens if you insult the future King of France.
Yeah.
At which point, out of the crowd comes the current King of France and goes, "Oi, not on my watch." And puts him to the sword. And it's just there's so much charisma in this performance.
Mm.
And yet it's like you don't know, because again, we're going back to the Robin Hoodness of this. Is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy?
It doesn't matter. He's the king.
He's the king, exactly. And or is, you know, is he someone that we should be rooting for or not? Then once we realise there's a more conventional villain in the film, then we know that and we see that he's star-tossed and he's been pushed around by his advisors. But even then, he remains interesting because he's a weak king who then suddenly becomes a strong king.
Yeah, but, you know, weak people become quite strong in this film. So there's who's the guy who takes credit for pushing back Burgundy, single-handedly defeating his men? And it's a complete lie, but,
yes,
you know, impresses the king. And basically, in The Beloved Rogue, you know, performing it, saying it is as good as doing it.
Absolutely, and he's a poet. And so, again, that's part of the sort of the deeper heart of what looks like a relatively shallow film.
Can we talk about John Barrymore then, please?
Okay, let's talk about John Barrymore and his wispy beard.
You know what, the thing is, I mean, he really is so lively in this film. I've seen, I was lucky enough to be at Pordenone when they had the sort of Barrymore retrospective, and I've seen him in his sort of early funny ones where he's just doing sort of quite sprightly comedy, and I've seen the more sort of generally admired serious and romantic things, and he can slow down too much. There can be too much treacle in it. Here, he's constantly moving.
Yep.
You only see that profile a few times.
Yeah, you do get to see it.
But, you know, it's really wonderful to see an actor who, you know, he obviously has great stage chops. And whenever you see him in his best films like this and Jekyll and Hyde and that, he knows exactly how to perform for the camera. And he's giving everything into that square. And you just can't take your eyes off him. When I saw The Beloved Rogue, I remember I came out quite sort of enchanted by it. I didn't think it was the most serious film. We have talked about its relationship to history. But something about his performance that really is astonishing.
There's lots to watch here. I do think that he hasn't quite got the register of the film. You know, I think the film is on a different register to him. And sometimes he overdoes it, sometimes he underplays it.
Mm-mm.
He's always amazingly watchable.
You could spin a whole film out of that sad clown moment, and then the whole film out of the rest of the sort of more lively. You know, you'd kind of want him to be almost a sort of co-star in a film with a more conventional romantic lead, and he could just really go for it. He could be a kind of Falstaff.
Yes.
A skinny Falstaff.
So we've talked about the two core protagonists of The Beloved Rogue, Neruda.
Neruda, so we've got two great performances again. I mean, neither of them is quite such a knockout.
No.
But then you could say they're more subtle. I think it's interesting, Luis Gnecco is not an actor that I knew particularly. He walks in and he has the charisma, even naked, or even with his eyeliner on. He has that, you can tell.
Oh, it undermines him straight away. I mean, the first thing, he plays the role to be taken shots at. You know, he's playing a role of a character who is fantastically charismatic that we're not supposed to see him being quite as charismatic as everyone around him sees him as. We see behind that shell in some ways.
Yeah, I think the moment when he encounters that young woman in the street and he gives her his jacket and he's like, I've got nothing for you. But, you know, all she really wants is to be near him. And there's a few encounters like that when people just want to be near him. I think he plays that really well. He's got a really sad face. Yeah, I mean, even though I sort of wanted to hate him quite a lot of the time, I couldn't because it's his film.
You can't. Well, is it his film? But yes, it is. by partnering him up or by putting him against Gael Garcia Bernal, who is one of the most attractive men in the world.
He is, apart from yourself, Pete.
Yes, but obviously present company was accepted.
But no, I mean, Gael Garcia Bernal in this, he's wonderful, actually, but actually he is doing exactly what he's told to do. He's playing a supporting character.
Yeah.
Even though he's playing a character who doesn't think he's a supporting character and, you know, riddle that, he's quite an underplayed performance. It's almost like he does sometimes let the look of the film work for him when he's leaning out of a hotel window with the neon light.
Yeah. No, and I think, you know, again, it's part of the casting of him, who is by far and away the biggest star in this, probably the one of the few global name Spanish leads or Spanish speaking leads in Mexican. Mm-hmm. The film is using his fame as a trick. You think he's the lead, he's doing the voiceover, he's the sexy one. The film's called Neruda is the only thing that might hint that it isn't, that isn't what's going on here.
But you could walk in and you could expect, once you've seen this setup, that this is going to be about the man who nabbed him. You know, and maybe he regrets it, you know, but he's so determined, he's so beautifully determined to do this. And the whole thing becomes quite grotesque. The whole scene with the ex-wife in the radio station is really bizarre because you think of him as such a sort of good man and then he just claps his hand over her mouth and drags her out of there.
So the degree that he represents this part of Neruda's psyche, the degree to which he represents Chile itself at that point in time, but he is downplaying his own natural charisma and being asked to do so, and I think does so well. But obviously there is that problem when someone is asked to downplay the charisma, which means that they don't have quite as much charisma as they would otherwise. And that does happen here. He does kind of implode in on himself, and certainly when we get to the very voiceover heavy final segment where he is questioning his own existence,
I found that so moving the first time.
If it had been snappy, I would have found it more moving, but I think by the time
things have to move fast for you,
well, it's fast and slow, and this was that bit was slow for me, whereas
Beloved Rogue is always fast, we can say.
Yes.
I think we're going to have to score this one, and I'm going to break my duck, and I'm going to give this to Beloved Rogue, because Conrad Veidt and John Barrymore, people.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you there. Though I don't want to make anyone think that the pair in Neruda don't have that kind of star power as well, because they do.
So we're going to go on to our final category now, and we're going to talk about style. Well, you wanted to call this section snow.
Yeah, because they both have a lot of snow in them.
Yeah, they do. I think I might finish this podcast now. I don't know, over it. Yeah.
Just style. No, okay, let's talk about style. you wouldn't let me have facial hair, so let's have
style, and we're talking about visual style here. So with the Beloved Rogue, we've got a bona fide great. We've got William Cameron Menzies designing this film, and everything does look fantastic. Does it look real? No.
Not super real, no.
But who cares about real? No. Everything looks like it's been made on the most beautiful three-dimensional set. It's that kind of medieval gothic with snow on curly roofs, and it's a fun playground for the characters.
And I don't know what 15th century Paris looked like, so...
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it looked like that.
No, it does look tremendous, and is... as you say, just fun to watch. Yeah.
The scenes are bursting with life, which I know is a terrible cliche, but, you know, when we have the All Fool's Day celebrations, this big crowd in the square, and, you know, we shouldn't like the fact that he has a little dwarf that follows him around, but he's running around, and everything's happening all at once. It's not always just about... Well, no. At the best moments, it's not just about John Barrymore in the foreground. No. The crowd scene with the banishment scene, I think, is fantastic.
Yes. Yeah, and I mean, that scene works really well and has a real sense of a mob. We're in front of what I'm assuming is supposed to be Notre Dame, and there's some great sort of model work and back projection in front and matting going on there as well. So, yeah, it just looks good. For a film which, you know, as we've discussed, is a semi-parody of this style, it nails the style. So maybe it nails it a little bit too well, so that we don't notice when it's going off or when it's tripping.
Maybe we needed the sets to wobble a little bit.
Maybe,
you know,
yeah.
That's kind of meta thing that we like these days.
Yeah.
So that is, wow, that's too good a segue. So there's something that happens in Neruda quite a lot, which is very self-consciously reminding you that you're watching a film, and that's all that lens flare.
Yes. Neruda, the first two thirds of Neruda is, as you said before, very interior. It's very dark. It's either at night time. You don't get a lot of daytime exteriors.
When you do, there's a burst of sun, and someone's head just emerges from this starburst. You don't know who it's going to be until Yeah, they're right in your face.
But certainly in that last third or that last quarter where our detective is questioning his own existence and so on, it is lens flare a go-go.
Mm.
And the more the film draws attention to its own existence as an artefact, it mirrors exactly that point where Bernal realises that as well, I think. I would never suggest that there's anything that's on the screen or as visual style in a Pablo Larraín movie that isn't there on purpose.
Oh, it's very... I mean, these are very well-controlled examples of a lens flare. Absolutely. I mean, it's definitely not there to sort of suggest nostalgia or any sort of cozy, you know, memory kind of thing like that. It's all about, I mean, as I say, sometimes it obscures figures and so you get to sort of have a sort of delayed reveal of people. And yeah, sometimes, as you say, it's drawing attention to how much it is a film. We talked about the back projection in the cars, and obviously everything that Gael Garcia Bernal wears is very self-conscious. I've absolutely no idea what police detectives in 1940s Chile wore, but they happen to wear, it seems, exactly what people in The Touch of Evil wore.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's great.
Indeed, yeah. No, exactly. I mean, it is set dressed to the nines, that stuff, and looks like it has been as well, and that's, it gives you that hint, I think.
And there's so many just striking images from Neruda. I think, like I said, definitely watching it again, like pacing maybe didn't work. But, you know, that beautiful drag singer in the brothel, I found that whole sequence again very moving. And it's just these aspects of costume that really work well. The white suit, the white jacket, and yeah, the drag and the Lawrence of Arabia costume all just show different sides of Neruda. And that's part of the romanticism of the film, I think. I really, really enjoyed looking at Neruda.
Oh, it looks amazing. I did too. You know, and I think, you know, I enjoyed it as an experience overall. You know, I think it hasn't lasted that well with me in time because of that pacing issue, and also because I feel that some of the issues around that, and I think some of those stylistic issues become a little bit too on the nose. Mm-hmm. You know, they become a little bit too self-conscious to the point that, yes, I get the point you're making. You've made that point. Now tell me more about Neruda. And the film isn't actually that interested at that point in telling you any more about Neruda. It's done a portrait of a character, of a real person, and it has a position on them and says, you know, this person was a great poet. That's a given. Were they a great thing for Chile?
Yeah.
Were they a great politician? You know, and I think there is that definite split between the interior and the border sequences, which are also mirrored within the character, because he goes from being clean-shaven to heavily bearded.
Well, I mean, everything for you is about hair.
It is, but I mean, because hair is quite important there as well. Because, of course, he is, Neruda at this point, is a relative, from a cinematic point of view, a relatively grotesque character.
He's a sort of handsome grotesque, jolly laid, whatever you call it. There's something about him that's very captivating. There's something about him that's very ugly. Yeah, that's
but
true.
He's not a good-looking man, but he is a very vain man.
Mm.
And he has to throw that vanity to the wind. Yeah. Yes, he does tie his belly in at some point, doesn't he? So.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really hard to sort of compare them on style, because one is just going for a full-on construct and the other is sort of playing with that. But I do think that there's nothing in Neruda that really quite gives me a full world of fun like The Beloved Rogue. So
yes.
I might veer towards my silent bias here.
Well, I'm going to go for Neruda, because in the end, if I'm talking about style, then I do think that, you know, Pablo Larraín is a king at this, and I think he's really on top of his game here. Maybe a little bit too on top of his game. Yeah, he might be overdoing it a bit too much. I mean, when I saw his film The Club, which is his serious take on Father Ted.
Pete, why do you have to ruin everything?
I'm sorry, that's what I do. He was asked afterwards about the shooting, and he went, well, I didn't really think about so much about the cinematography here or the stock. He was asked about the stock he filmed it on. It was like, wasn't an issue so much here, because it wasn't important to the way I wanted to tell the story. And the person at the film festival asking that question looked so disappointed. They couldn't add another weird format to their list. But it is what he does, and I think it's great.
So, I mean, what's your impression? Because I have the scores in front of me.
Yeah.
Which film do you think won?
I think Neruda won.
Yeah, you're right. Neruda got 7 points and Beloved Rogue got 5, which is tighter than I expected, although it's possible that maybe I started feeling sorry for it.
It is possible, and there are a few places where we might have given it a few points, which may have been a bit generous.
For me, only twice, but you 3 times. So.
I would say that they are both worth watching. You know, I would go and see Neruda. It's out in cinemas at the moment.
Exactly, and you can find Beloved Rogue in the bad way, but I do heartily recommend watching it on a nice print, because I was lucky enough to watch it at Pordenone and we saw it beautifully in crisp.
Yes.
So it was a slightly odd pairing, I think. Unless you, like me, had seen both films. Did you find that watching The Beloved Rogue gave you any insight into Neruda?
Before? Having had this conversation, it has, yeah. I mean, you know, it was interesting. It's always interesting to take two things which are quite different and try to draw out similarities. And I think there are some interesting things going on here. But they're not obvious pairing. As I say, you know, A Quiet Passion would have been an interesting one to throw in as well, because it is, you know, that's all about the poetry. But, you know, going back to women's stories as well, which both of these films aren't great with.
That's one of the reasons. It's quite hard to find a pairing for A Quiet Passion. I would have. Yes, yeah. I had to pick between the two films.
I think you did a good job, and as ever. But
it wasn't hunting for a compliment there.
As we would always say to our listeners as well, is if you see a film coming out in the next couple of weeks and you can think of a really great pairing with it, please let us know.
Yeah, tweet Silent London. And what we're going to do is, when we've decided on the pairing for the next film, which will probably, the next podcast will probably come out in about a fortnight, so a week before then, or a few days before the podcast comes out, we'll let you know what the pairing is. So if you want to get ahead and watch the films, in fact, you know, after this, we'll just go and have a cup of tea and work out what that's going to be.
Probably do that, yeah. So you can play along too.
Exactly. Please do visit silentlondon.co.uk and find out more Silent London stuff. Check out more podcasts, links to all kinds of things that you might be interested in there. And you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. And it's also available on
SOAS Radio,
which is where we are right now.
Indeed, yes.
So we're coming at you from the heart of Bloomsbury, which is why the repartee and the critical debate is of such a high standard.
And we're so obsessed with moustaches.
And also why we're dressed in each other's clothes. So, goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
Bye.
Esto tiene que ser una cacería salvaje.